This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh boy, I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Lynn Hightower. She was here a month ago to talk about her most recent release, The Beautiful Risk, which was a book that I just found so fascinating. And I will talk a little bit more about that today because I really want all of you to get it. But I'm so happy that Lynn is joining me today to talk about writing. She is also a famous writing coach. She knows what she's talking about because she is an award-winning journalist and author, and I was so really thrilled that she agreed to come on and talk about the important things that writers need to know or that they need to stop thinking about, because NaNoWriMo is coming up in November, and I know many of my listeners are already gearing up, and they want to get ready to really prove to themselves that they can write. So, Lynn, welcome to Joy on Paper again.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here, and I've got so many things to tell novelists. Well, and all writers, actually.
Well, that's great, and that's exactly what we want. We want real solid advice on how to really get out there and start writing and keep writing and not lose that joy that I'm always talking about on paper, not to get frustrated. Yeah. And I think you are the ideal person to tell my listeners, because you have a writing, your sort of idea is that you are talking to people, writers to writers, that you're going to make sure that everybody really feels comfortable, and your program is called Novelist to Novelist, but it works for all writers. So tell us about your program, and what are the five things that you have discovered over your years of teaching that are important for writers to know about?
Okay. You know, when I work with writers and novelists, I work writer to writer because we all have to be careful who we listen to. All right.
Just a minute. We have a little bit of. Are you sitting close enough to your phone or whatever?
Yeah, let me change the audio on it. Maybe that'll.
Yeah,
help.
Because we're getting a little bit of static, and I want to make sure that everybody hears your advice.
Okay. How about this?
That's much better. Perfect.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. You have to be. All of us who are writers have to be careful who we listen to. An editor, an agent are brilliant at telling you if the story's working, where they have a question, what's not working. Listen to them when they tell you that. They are not able to tell you how to do it, a technique to do it. That is where you have to work novelist to novelist. If you're not working with anybody, you have a million books out there to read. Go look and see how other authors do it, okay? And the very first thing I want to tell you is we're all wondering sometimes, we have a novel in our head or we're like, really, what should I write about? What's this way in the market and that way in the market? And what should I write? And that answer is really very simple. Always tell the story that you wish someone would tell you. If you're walking through a bookstore, what would be the most perfect book for you to grab, run home with, and curl up with that very night? What are you passionate about, fascinated by? What makes you angry? Follow it up in your novel, because the thrilling thing about writing, particularly fiction, is that you're in charge of the world and the outcome belongs to you.
That's an exciting thing. The power. You have power.
You do. You have enormous power. If you're writing nonfiction, and I've written articles in nonfiction, then I was all over what was really going on and what did I want to know and what did it mean to a regular person, okay? And you know, when I was writing journalism articles and I interviewed someone, if they said something that seemed weird or off, I wasn't going to put it in the article. I was going to say to them, listen, this is, it sounds like you're saying this. Is that what you really mean? Is that what you want people to get from this interview with you? I want to really be clear about your thinking on this. And people appreciate that. It keeps you from slanting things, right? It just hits on a very personal and human level, which you do nonfiction or fiction, if you're honest about it.
Now, authors, of course, always hear this term, find your voice. And I can't tell you how many times I've been at a writer's meeting or a meeting, you know, a library meeting where we're talking about to people who are just, you know, starting off, or they're just thinking about it, and they say, well, I don't know what my voice is. I don't know how to find a voice. And I say, you got to get something on paper.
I can tell you everything you need to know in just a few minutes. Seriously. Okay?
Okay.
When editors and agents say, find your voice, okay, what they know is that voice is the emotional connection between the story and the reader. And that's why it's so crucial. I'm sorry, but they're clueless about how to work voice, find it, develop it. And the point is, the voice is the voice of the story, the voice of the character, okay? And so it's not this mysterious thing that cannot be taught. Let's boil it down. Let your character give voice to their opinions. Sometimes the more outrageous, the better. And a lot of times my characters are giving voice to my opinions, and they seem to take it places that I didn't have the nerve to do it, and it's thrilling to write, and it's thrilling to read. So what are your character's passions? What are they afraid of? What are their genuine emotions? What really makes them angry? Okay? A lot of my characters are angry about some things, and they say so. And so many readers were like, oh, I laughed so hard when I read that. I feel the same way. Okay? That's the emotional connection. So you have to tell us who your characters are and let them come through on the page with their voice, which is their opinions, their emotions, and how they feel about the world. The more you do it, the easier it gets. And my suggestion to you as you're writing is not to get boxed into a particular scene or plot place in the novel, but to sit down and just let it rip and let your character talk. Talk, let them talk, write it down and channel it. It's part you, it's part them, it's part the mysterious, magical things that happen when you write. And if you just sit and free write that, then you will have a wealth of material that you can cut and paste into the novel as you go.
So you really have to know your character. And this is one of the problems that I've discovered with some authors, you know, just starting off. They have an idea for a character, but they never flesh it out. Now,
right.
I've been writing a book for quite a few years. I'm so busy, but I have a character, and I fell in love with this guy when I started writing the book. And over the years,
right.
I mean, I love him so much. I mean, sometimes at like 4:30 in the morning when I start on my computer, my first cup of coffee, I see him sort of sitting in the corner saying, like, when are you getting back to me?
I believe that, and I think that you should get back to him. He's there, he's waiting.
He is.
And I just think your stories exist, and you're just pulling the threads, but they're already there.
And how, you know, should authors, when they're starting, when they're writing a book, how should they work on developing that character? Should they, first of all, should there be a kind of, you know, we hear about the style sheet where people will actually, you write down so you know about your character, and you know some of the, it's sometimes important to know a lot of little background things about a character that you might not use in the book. For example, in my book, I happen to know just from a letter in my research that this guy, when he was little, his teacher hit him with a ruler. And his mother broke that ruler. Now, that's not relevant to the story I'm writing about him as a grown man and a very important man, but I live with that always. I always know, I know what he feels like.
I think that's really a crucial thing to know, and I think you won't find that on any, you know, list of to-do list on how to make a character, which, you know, if they work for you, great, but I think they box you in. To me, they box me in. But I would actually put that in the book. All the little stories you've heard throughout your life, things that happened to you, things that happened to other people that you remember because they grabbed you emotionally, you can pour right into that character. And if it helps you to click off boxes, eye color, blah, 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 if that helps you, you do what works for your process. To me, that's like a Mr. Potato Head. I come up with the emotion they're feeling, things that happened in their past that make them angry that they want to make right. And then actually I put them right into the middle of trouble immediately and start writing them. And I accept that they're going to develop as I write. I cannot sit down with a fully developed character and then start the novel. Start the novel, walk that path with your character. Don't be afraid if you don't know everything, but pay attention and learn as you go.
Well, that's like I mentioned your most recent book, The Beautiful Risk. You certainly put Junie, your main character, right in the middle of a big mess in her life.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yeah. And how you react, what makes you angry, the things that you'll do. You know, my character, Junie Lagarde, does not follow the rules, and she doesn't care. She doesn't care what anybody thinks. She doesn't care what the outcome is. She's going to do what she's going to do, which is a thrilling way to live your life, and she's absolutely my hero, and I want to be her in that attitude. So walking along behind her, and she does these outrageous things because characters that are a little bigger than life, right? I like it when the characters say the cool things they're thinking. Don't just have them think cool thoughts. Actually have them say them out loud and throw it out on the scene because it just gives the scene charisma and presence dropped because the character is saying things that we as just regular humans wish we could say. Oh my gosh, I wish I'd said that. Oh my gosh, I wish I could have told him that. And if you let your characters do that, your readers are going to love you.
Well, isn't it funny how we're talking about Junie? I mean, she's a character, but to me, as I was reading the book, Junie was so real. I got, I mean, I just, I was thrilled as I was reading it because I don't know, along the way, as you're writing her, she became more and more, you know, real to you, too.
Yes, she did. She did. She had such a presence. You know, with some novels, the character just, like, lands at your feet and says, pay attention, I'm off and running, and you go after as fast as you can. And that's just magical, right? It doesn't always happen that way, but you will find them. If it happens magically, oh my gosh, run with it, okay? And if it doesn't, just follow them. Maybe they're speaking softly, and you kind of have to seduce them into your life and into your office.
Now, as a coach, how do you approach somebody who comes to you and they say, I have, sometimes they come perhaps early in the process that they're just coming out with the idea. Sometimes they've already started and they're stuck. Sometimes an author recently said, you know, she started her book 10 years ago and just like didn't know what to do. And then finally she got, you know, her sort of act together, and she came out with a really great book. So how do you personally work with people?
Well, you see, I have made every possible mistake you can make, and then I had to figure out how to get out of trouble. So whatever has gotten you stuck, I've been there, I've gone through it, and I can tell you what I did, all right? Because we are all so much the same. We have all the same problems. And sometimes it helps to just have spitball sessions, you know, in a Zoom. Tell me about your character. Tell me why you're stuck. Tell me what worries you. And then what we do is we find, oh, 99 times out of 100, the issue is I wasn't sure where the story went next, so I kind of just went on this tangent, which was kind of fun, but it doesn't really relate to the story. And the answer is, well, where does the story go next? And So you might have to do a little planning and say, oh, I think this terrible thing could happen, or this would be the logical outcome, but I don't like it. I want it to go this way. And then you just say, how could you make it go that way? And then you also think about things in great depth, how it affects your character, what they really want. What are they willing to do? Are they protecting someone? Are they finding someone out? Are they hell-bent on revenge? You know, so when you spitball about this, I get to the point with my writers where they write these things down. I have an exercise I do, which I call the ramble. And I say, I don't want you to worry about how long this takes or what order it's in. I want you to tell me things you think work in the novel, ideas you have, things you thought about, emotions they have, events that happen, and just send me a ramble. And I'm going to read it, and I'm going to give you integrated feedback on it where we're just kind of having a conversation on the page, and then we might Zoom and talk about it. And what happens is, the next thing you know, they're like, oh, I know exactly what I want to do. Oh, my gosh, I'm so excited. I cannot wait to sit down and write this scene. And then I know we're off and running, and that happens all the time.
Well, can you give an example of one of the books or one of the authors that you helped, how a problem that they might have had and how you overcame it with them?
Yes, I was working with an author on a character who was an older woman, with the last maybe 10 or 20 years of her life, and she was younger. And, you know, there are all so many tropes about what it's like to be a woman of a certain age or a man of a certain age. And she didn't want to write the trope, but she didn't know where to go, okay? So we started talking about that. And what we came to was that, well, there are all these expectations for what a woman, how a woman will live her life. And we came to the realization this woman had more autonomy. Her children were raised. She was leaving a marriage. She had more autonomy than she'd ever had in her life. And it was exciting because now she could do anything she wanted to do. And because she'd lived a while, she knew exactly what that was. So when we kicked that around, she's like, oh, I know. Okay, so it's not about what people expect her to do. It's about what she wants to do, but it up against the expectations about what they wanted her to do. And she was just laughing. She says, I've got so many ideas for this. And so she would write and send me pages, and we would go forward like that. This is her creation, her character, her setup. So what I'm doing is coaching her through on how to look at it, how to parse it, how to find the way with the character and the plot that's true to her vision of this novel and where she wanted it to go.
So you work with authors who have a completed book, and you work with authors who are sort of just in the beginning process?
I work at any stage of the process. I work with writers who are published. I work with writers who are not published. I think that everybody should be writing a novel. I think it's crucial to the creative inner life, and I also think it's therapeutic to write things and let your character live them and walk behind them and go, oh, that's how they handled it. This is what I'm going to do. Or, yeah, that got them in trouble. I might go a little different route. So I don't think writing novels is for the cool kids club. I think writing novels is essential to a good life.
I agree. This is one of the things I've been telling people, you know, definitely since I started the program over 9 years ago, that just the process of putting words on paper will sometimes surprise you. I give people this challenge. They say, just give yourself, you know, 2 sheets of paper and just write it by hand. You don't have to have a computer. And then when you put it away for a minute, a little while, and then come back and you say, wow, I can write. I can actually put words. And not everything's
totally
right. But it is. Yeah. It's like a miracle.
It is. It's magic. So you just find the magic. It's right out there for you to get hold of. It really is.
And it's really so good for the brain because people, mm-hmm. You are how can I say, brains are degenerating rapidly because all the, you know, so many people are on devices or they're watching television, which is repetitive, the same thing over and over and over. And it does not work those, like Hercule Poirot, you have those gray cells and you have to keep them busy. You have to feed them. And that's what writing does, because it's on so many levels, both a physical level, whether you're writing by hand or you're typing, it's a process. Mm-hmm. And then just seeing the words in front of you. And then, of course, one of the things, it's exciting when you realize I can use words and I can learn new words and I can learn mm-hmm. ways to use them.
Yes, yes. And I really think beautiful writing is about precision in writing, not pretty words, not trying to dress them up. The more precisely you write, how you really nail things simply and straight from the heart, makes for the most beautiful work.
Now, do you advise, like if you're working with an author, do you advise them to read particular books? And I'm talking perhaps famous novels. One of the things I was talking to somebody and I said, do you realize how little Jane Austen actually explains in the book? You come mm-hmm. away from that book. She doesn't need a lot of words to draw a picture that is indelible. It stays with you forever, particularly mm-hmm. Charlotte Bronte. When you read Jane Eyre, if you analyze it, you say, well, she didn't really describe things very well. But I mean, we see it so perfectly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's very precise. It's very much on the page. And one thing she does, which I think is extremely important, and it's the one thing I want people to know, is she tells you quickly what you need to know in a summary. This was the kind of man who blah, 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 right? This is the kind of restaurant where you didn't go with your children unless you had two nannies. That tells you everything you need to know about that restaurant. That is the power of telling. Writers are always told, show. Well, that's very stunted advice. You show emotion, yes, okay? But you have to tell a plot. You cannot give us a plot without telling us. And clarity is crucial. And if you summarize, I call it hit and run writing. You summarize exactly what the reader needs to know and you give it to them and you keep on going. They're so grateful. They're like, oh, great. Now I know what's going on. Let's go. So tell emotion, you know, show emotions, but tell facts and go ahead and summarize and tell us everything we need.
And just learn to use the exact, that sentence that you just gave described a restaurant. People can imagine it. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what Charlotte Bronte did, what all the Brontes did. And,
yeah.
You know, that's in a few words. It
right.
makes, it just paints a picture that yes. stays with you forever. And you don't have to then say, and the color of the carpet was purple, and this was this, and that was this. You know, sometimes you'll find a lot of books like that where they write details and details and details. And
mm-hmm.
all it.
You have to be careful with your details.
Yeah, details are great, but if you can just paint that picture like you did with one sentence, we knew that mm-hmm. restaurant didn't want kids.
And it's so easy when you get in the habit of it. It's just so easy. It's like a shortcut. It's like, oh my gosh, it's going to take me 60 pages to get this across. And I'm like, or I could just tell them in two sentences. And just, I'm rooting for the two sentences version. I promise you that.
I am too, because it's clear, it's crisp, it's fresh, and it stays for forever. You don't have to, you know, it's a kind of writing, which is why we read Jane Austen over and over, why we read Charlotte Bronte and all of the greats, because mm-hmm. they did it, and they gave us that picture that we needed, and it stays with us. And you did that with one simple sentence, and that's an example of a great writing coach. So,
thank you. You know, it's attitude. A lot of it's attitude, too. There's a little attitude behind that sentence, and isn't that fun?
It is. It's perfect. I love it. So, Lynn Hightower, I'm so happy that you joined me today. Tell people how they can contact you.
Contact me through my website, which is www.lynnhightower.com, and it's L-Y-N-N HIGHTOWER. Get me through the website, and I'll get back to you, and we'll talk.
And she has about her books, about her life, and mostly goes straight to this novelist to novelist. It will really open your eyes. And as you can see, Lynn can do it in a sentence. And I think you're wonderful. And of course, everybody, The Beautiful Risk is a great book. It's set in France, and as I told you when you were on, that I was in all locations of that book. And it features, for all of you dog lovers, it features a German Shepherd. So just one quickly, tell us a little bit about the hero of the book.
Let's just boil it down to something really quick, okay? I'm going to give it to you in dramatic beats, which is how I sell books to publishers. I don't do a synopsis. Here's what I'm going to say. Her dog is missing. Her husband is dead. And she is the most dangerous person in the room. There you go.
There you go. Lynn Hightower, a fantastic writing coach. And it was a joy to talk to you today, Lynn.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay. Bye-bye. Wow. That's great. All right. We'll do a quick... you know, Big Ed in the control room, we're going to run out of time. So all I'm going to do is let's do the Jim Lamb, because since we're talking about writing, and we'll do that. Did you find that? Oh, well, play one of Jim Lamb's literary gems, and then we'll come back with my next guest, which is a Nat Geo editor.
Mark Twain said, if you see an adverb, kill it. Elmore Leonard said, using adverbs is a mortal sin. And I can't even repeat what Stephen King said. The horror. An adverb is a part of speech that, when used right, is heavenly. But when used too often, yuck. Hi, I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. There was a popular TV show for kids back in the 70s called Schoolhouse Rock. I loved it. Schoolhouse Rock covered a variety of topics, including grammar, science, history, and math. My favorite episode was about adverbs. It went like this. Lolly, 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 get your adverbs here. Got a lot of lolly, jolly adverbs here. The lively little tune explained that an adverb is a word that modifies a verb. It can also modify an adjective, another adverb, or even a group of words. The Lolly song claimed that an adverb was positively very, very necessary. There's just one problem. It's not necessary, that is. Why? Because some writers overuse adverbs. Others don't know how to use them. And some writers use adverbs to add to their word count without adding any value. And that's a very, 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 very wrong thing to do. However, when used wisely, an adverb can clarify. For example, take this sentence. The painter painted the house. Makes sense, doesn't it? Now let's add an adverb. The painter painted the house neatly. Notice how the adverb clarifies what kind of job the painter did? Another nice thing about adverbs is how quick you can make one. Quick becomes quickly by simply adding an ly. Slow becomes slowly. Neat is transformed into neatly. And remember, an adverb can modify or qualify, and in doing so express a relationship in terms of time, space, circumstance, manner, cause, or degree. For example, consider the following. I felt the movie ended abruptly. Aunt Jenny's teacup must be handled gently. My neighbor answered the survey truthfully. Here's some context. Carefully, correctly, and easily are adverbs of manner. Adverbs of place, here, there, outside. Adverbs of time, early, soon, tomorrow. Adverbs of frequency, always, daily, seldom. So remember, use adverbs thoughtfully, carefully, but with restraint. I'm Jim Lamb, and you've just learned a little something-something about adverbs.
Hi, okay, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, and this is so exciting, always, when I have a Nat Geo book on, and I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Ariane Zutu, right? Did I pronounce it? Zutu?
Yes, you did. Hi.
Hi, Ariane. Wow, this is wonderful. You know, there's so many things I love about this book, but I think perhaps the one that really got me the most was learning Donald Duck's middle name.
Oh, yes, I know, Fauntleroy.
Wow, isn't that cool? I didn't know that. I love it. It changes my whole life. Like, I needed to know this. I really needed to know this because he was my favorite when I was young. It was Donald Duck. My mother had one of those Donald Duck, one of the early ones, those little toys. It was antique, and I don't know, somewhere along the line we lost it, but I remember it, and I just love that toy. So, Fauntleroy.
That's wonderful. Well, there are 299 other facts in Weird Richard Disney that are sure to delight fans of Disney and Weird But True and National Geographic, and I love that you love that fact. I think one of my favorites is that the manatees at the seas with Nemo and friends at Epcot eat more than 100 heads of lettuce a day. I sometimes forget that, you know, at Disney there are animals, actually, you know, like at Animal Kingdom, for example. We have another fact in the book that Dino, a silverback gorilla at Disney's Animal Kingdom, celebrated his 41st birthday with a cake made of alfalfa, banana leaves, and sweet potato frosting. And we have an amazing image of Gino looking very majestic.
Well, of course, all of the photographs in the book are fantastic. And as a senior editor for National Geographic Kids, you must have so much fun just looking at the photographs.
Oh my gosh, so much, and so much fun putting, you know, something like this together. You know, we are very aware that people who love Disney know Disney in and out. And so, you know, I wasn't sure how difficult or easy it would be to come up with 300 facts that are still going to be surprising to people, especially fans of Disney. And I'm happy to say that we came up with so many facts. I mean, there are so many surprising things about the creation of Disney movies and the incredible attention to detail film creators had to get every scene just right, whether it's, you know, learning how a snowflake forms from a NASA scientist to when they were making the film Frozen, or, you know, modeling things in movies after real life places. There's just so much content to draw from.
It's wonderful. And of course, what I love are all the inspirations for characters, because you know, of course, the people at Disney are brilliant at this, and they can look at something and come out with a character. And one of the ones that sort of freaked me out, I can tell you, I'm going to send this book to my brother because it's going to freak him out. He doesn't like creepy crawly things. But Dean Hardscrabble from Monster Universe was inspired by this frightening. I mean, I turned to the page. I think it's in the middle of the book, and it's like the first page I opened, and it's a venomous Amazonian giant centipede. And it says,
yes.
It says it grows a foot long. It would freak me out if I saw that.
Yes, there's so much real-world inspiration that, you know, that's behind some of the beloved Disney characters. And, you know, it's funny, you know, I think some people were kind of wondering, you know, why Nat Geo Kids is pairing up with Disney. You know, Disney does, you know, is our parent company, but I think it really, there is just sort of a natural fit here, and we wanted to create something extra special in this flagship series for us that celebrated Disney's centennial, which is happening, I believe, this month, actually. So, you know, it was just a really nice way to kind of bring everything together.
And they didn't send you this footlong centipede so that you know it's real.
Right. I thankfully, unlike the filmmakers, did not have to dive quite that deep into the research. But I will say there's some really cool facts in this book about, you know, the incredible things the film creators had to do, you know, like I was mentioning. And one of them is for the when they were creating Finding Nemo, the film creators had to go scuba diving because they wanted to see the main characters of their film in the wild to make sure that they were capturing everything correctly. And I thought, what an amazing job. You have to go scuba diving as part of your job to do your research. That's just incredible to me.
Well, National Geographic photographers are amazing. They go to places, well, they go every place in the world, over 100 years. Nat Geo photographers have been somewhere, someplace, taking a photograph. But one of the cutest ones is this idea of when they were looking for penguins and trying to get up close for the movie.
Yes, that was for one of the Disney nature films. They actually, I forget the exact facts specifically, but I know that filmmakers had to cross a glacier. I want to say it was like for 10 days or something while they were creating this documentary. Let me see if I can find it. But yeah, it was... there's just so much effort that goes into these films, and you can understand why they take so long to create, because there's so much artistry and attention to detail with every single scene.
Well, it's a nice assignment to be sent to the Antarctic, but then to be told you have to wear a penguin mask because we want you to blend in.
Right, exactly. There's so much fun stuff. It'd be amazing to be a fly on the wall for the Disney filmmaker discussions.
Well, I was a little disappointed that the actress who played Cinderella didn't get to walk in the crystal heels.
Right. Yeah, there's so many facts like that in here. One thing that I thought was really interesting is that Bruce, the great white shark in Finding Nemo, has 202 teeth, and each one was animated. And I found that really fascinating.
Well, they are so clever, the animators there. What they can do, sometimes it's just so stunning, you can't believe it. But I love all of the stories. So when you were... you sit down, you have a group of people, and you guys get to go through and pick out the best ones. Tell us a little bit about the one, the 400,000 coins in the Caribbean attraction. I didn't know there were that many.
Oh, my goodness, yes. So the treasure scene in Disneyland Parts of the Caribbean attraction contains about 400,000 coins, and if you think that's impressive, I don't know if folks are familiar with the first 101 Dalmatians, the animated one, but I know that there were over 6 million spots created for that film, and that was in the days before CGI was super widespread and really used. So, people had to draw those 6 million spots. I feel like I would be seeing spots after doing that.
Did you do the summit plummet?
No, I have never done that before. I've actually never, that's on the cruise, right? If I'm not mistaken.
It's a 12-story tall drop?
Oh, that's right. Sorry, I was getting that confused with the ride that's on one of the Disney cruises. Yes, the Summit Plummet Water Slide at Disneyland's Blizzard Beach Water Park sends riders down a 12-story tall drop at up to 60 miles an hour. I've not personally done that. Have you done it before?
No, and I'm not sure that I would do that. 60 miles an hour. I don't drive 60 miles an hour. My husband would say to me, do you ever drive above 55? And I said, well, that's the speed limit, dear. So I'm not sure I'd do that. But it looks nice.
Yeah, we've got a cool photo of it. We've got information and Weaver True Disney about the different rides, like cool stats and figures and surprising information about them, like that there's a basketball hoop at the top of the Matterhorn ride. There are other like little secret nuggets of things, like little Easter egg things that readers can find and discover if anyone has plans to go to one of the parks. I highly recommend grabbing a copy of Weird Richard Disney and just bringing it with you. Our photo editor for this book actually did just that, and she got an advanced copy. She brought it with her to Disney World and found the places and the attractions that we mentioned in the book. And she took little videos. So, for example, for the, you know, the facts about manatees eating 100 heads of lettuce a day at Epcot, she had a video of, you know, you're like looking at the facts in the book, and she kind of pans up and out. And then you're looking down at this little manatee, or I guess big manatee, floating in this beautiful pool surrounded by these heads of lettuce, and it's just slowly munching. It's just very cute. So I highly recommend grabbing a copy of this before you go to anything Disney.
Oh, absolutely, because it really makes it so much more fun to know all of this, and it gives you something to talk about. And I think, of course, it's just the perfect souvenir because it will always remind you of all the great things that you find at Disney. I liked,
absolutely.
I liked the one I liked was Lucky, which is a 9-foot tall dinosaur that they made, and I had never seen that. Have you ever seen it in real Dinoland?
No, I have not. I clearly need to make a trip to more Disney parks. But yes, in 2005, Lucky, a 9-foot, 450-pound dinosaur, Disney's first free-roaming audio animatronic figure, walked Dinoland in Disney's Animal Kingdom. And I just cannot even imagine the look on kids' faces seeing this dinosaur walking around.
Well, I think it would be fantastic. And I personally made a dinosaur, a 30-foot dinosaur, I was working backstage in the theater, and I built it out of papier mâché. And it was 30 feet tall, and it was really, really amazing. And it was also, we had some moving parts in it, so we could move the head, and it was wonderful. So, but I'd love to see this one. This is nice. Wow.
That's
fantastic.
Incredible.
Yeah, so absolutely wonderful idea here. Now, what is this, jump out and add a scary surprise?
Well, I know that there was an employee, actually, at one of the Disney parks who, for the Haunted Mansion, he dressed up as a knight and jumped out at people. I forget when that was, but yeah, we have a fact about that in the book.
So again,
it's perfect for Halloween.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is Halloween time, and I'm sure at Disney, they always get a big crowd at Halloween time to go through everything, so that's fun. And
absolutely. And we've got some other Haunted Mansion and, you know, facts in the book that are pretty cool.
Oh, I like the idea that Walt Disney liked the dress that... Cinderella's dress, and how it was made in those days. I guess it was different. You know, the animation was different, so it was pretty exciting for him. Now, when you know, it's just looking at some of these characters, like, for example, Mickey Mouse, we can find out. I'm not going to tell people when his birthday is. You have to get this book, but they have Mickey Mouse's birthday in there. And now that you know Donald Duck's middle name, you have to discover Mickey Mouse's birthday. And that's one of the facts in here. There's so many wonderful facts. I like that some of the, in Epcot, where they're growing vegetables, they actually use the vegetables and fruits.
Yeah, that was surprising to at least me as well. I didn't realize, like, how, I mean, I kind of knew that the Disney parks are sort of this, like, self-contained, you know, just microcosm kind of. But I didn't fully realize that, yeah, there are greenhouses at Epcot that, for example, grow cucumbers in the shape of Mickey Mouse's head. So if you get a slice of cucumber at Disney World, for example, take a look at it. You might see two ears and the little round face. We've got a photo of that in the book, too.
And, of course, maybe they're growing the lettuce for the manatees there.
Right. I won't say definitively because I'm not sure if that's in the book, I don't recall. And I don't want to say anything.
No, it's not in the book, but
it's very possible.
It's very possible because that's a wonderful reason to have Epcot Center. I love Epcot Center.
Yes, you do. It's been a while.
I've been there so many times, and I love it. Every time I find and discover something new, it's really exciting. So.
Oh, yeah, and there's another fact in here, too, about I want to say it was the Eiffel Tower at Epcot. So Gustav Eiffel's blueprints were used to create the Eiffel Tower in the France Pavilion at Epcot. So I think that just goes to show the incredible attention to detail when these parks were created. So, you know, the actual blueprints for the Eiffel Tower were used to create the miniature that you see at Epcot. I think that's just incredible.
It is. And, the detail that they've always shown in developing everything, it's just from the Jungle Cruises to everything else in the park, so detailed, which is what makes it so much fun. Because you can go so many times because you always see something new.
It's so much fun. I mean, aside from the rides themselves being fun, it's definitely super fun. And, you know, we've got facts in this book that, you know, are about the parks, but also ones about the films and about the history of Disney, like, you know, that Walt himself actually was the voice of Mickey Mouse for some 20 years. I don't want to give away
everybody has to get this book. It's wonderful. I love, you really have, I one of the ones I love too, because I love elephants. I love the story about elephants and bees. People, you have to get this book. It is just fun. As always with Nat Geo, the quality is perfect. The book feels so good. The cover is fantastic. The paper, everything is just perfect. It's really top of the line production. So these books will last forever. Really, nobody will. First of all, nobody will want to give them away because once you get a Nat Geo book, you love them forever. And for me, I was raised on Nat Geo magazines. They changed my life, and that's why I love to have somebody from Nat Geo on. And for you, and it is pronounced Arian Zutu, right?
Yeah.
Arian Zutu, and it's spelled S-Z-U-T-U. So it's a lovely name. It's a beautiful name. And
Thank you.
Want to tell people also, as I always do when I have Nat Geo Kids book on, if you don't have a kid in your life, you can still buy this book, order this book, go online and order it and have it sent to a children's hospital near you, or to St. Jude's, or to Shriners Hospital, because a kid in a hospital will love this book. I mean, this will give them hours of joy.
That's such a great idea. I love that.
Yeah, that's absolutely the perfect gift. And as I said, it's now October, and November is coming up. And for me, November is National Geographic Month. And I always promote National Geographic books during November because I believe that everybody, when you go to somebody's house for Thanksgiving, you should be bringing a Nat Geo book with you.
Okay. I love that. Thank you so much.
So again, Arianne, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper, and thanks to everybody at Nat Geo and Disney. We have to, maybe they should send you that centipede just for fun.
Okay. I love that idea.
Okay.
Big fan of that.
Okay. Well, you take care, and it was really a joy to talk to you, and thanks again for being on Joy on Paper.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. What a... the book, it's shining. It has a cover. I'm holding it up to the camera. It's so beautiful. I can... And I have spent... spent a lot of time. The one thing about Nat Geo books like this, when I get them, I always say, well, I'm so busy, so I can read it once, and then I put it on my table next to my reading chair, and then I pick it up again, and I pick it up again, and I think since I've had this book like for maybe a month, I've picked it up a dozen times, and I've read it again through, and I pick it up. It's just an absolute joy of a book. Anyway, so today is the release date for Tasha Alexander's newest book, book 17 in her Lady Emily series, and I'm so happy for her. It is called I will have it right by the time she gets here for her interview, which will be in 2 weeks because she's so busy with the promotion for the book. And we have lots to talk about with Tasha Alexander and her husband, Andrew Grant. He's going to be here because he also has a new book, a Jack Reacher book, out. So it's really exciting for both of them to have a release in the same month, and I'm so happy that they're going to be joining me on Thursday, October 19th, and they will both be here together, and we will be talking about both of their books, and so that's going to be coming up. And what else? Thank you. I hope all of you, I really appreciated your emails about what Bill Larson advised you about, you know, for your intellectual property questions. He was very happy to do it, and I'm happy that if you have any follow-up, please contact him at Larson & Larson Patent Law, and he will talk to you, particularly to those of you who have ideas for, well, for characters or for animals or, well, products. And he also does trademarks, so if you have a trademark, as several of you sent me information about your characters and stuffed animals that you're hoping to make out of your characters or products or toys, make sure that you contact Bill Larson at Larson & Larson Patent Law, and he will walk you through registering a trademark, because you do not want to go ahead and order. Do not send a sketch to somebody in a foreign country and say, would you make this for me without having a trademark, because they will make it and they will steal it, and that will be that. So then you have no recourse. So make sure that if you have a product, as two of you have written to me, they sound great. It really sounds, your characters and your toys sound wonderful, but please trademark before you show them to anybody else. It was nice that you sent me ideas. I'm not going to steal it. I've got enough to do with everything, but it's dangerous to send that kind of stuff out. Really, it is, because you never know. Look, I was just talking about Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. Donald Duck, I love it. Just fantastic. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries, because they are fantastic. Her new one is out, and she's going to have a birthday, big birthday party. It will be on my website, so you can go in and find out about it. Anyway, everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day, and say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. And he saluted me. I saluted him, because I should have been a general, and I would have had good use for that pension. Okay, bye-bye now.